Hello, friends. This is the Environment Show, and welcome.
When you're in a crisis situation, it's hard to be innovative when you're thinking. And these people learn some of these little secrets, if you want to call them that, ahead of time by coming to this school. Because we deal with this stuff every week, so, you know, we should be experts in it. They don't deal with it every week. That's one of the major problems with this kind of crisis.
So as much as astronomers look outward from the Earth, part of our minds are always set on it and mindful of how careful we have to be.
Former Coast Guard captain and now professor Tim McKenna, director of the only oil spill school in the nation, explaining how his simulated oil spills at Texas A&M can prepare technicians for the real thing. And Dr. Karen Quitter, chair of the Williams College Astronomy Department, anxiously awaiting the first real pictures from the space telescope. Two of our guests and our stories this time on The Environment Show. We hope you'll stay with us. The Environment Show is a production of WAMC and is made possible by the J.M. Kaplan Fund of New York, and this is Bruce Robertson. While the spilling goes on, small slicks created from ships pumping bilge water, huge slicks from supertankers, 11 million gallons from the Exxon Valdez in Alaska, 4 million from the Megaborg off the coast of Texas. There was the Huntington Beach spill in California and dozens in the New York-New Jersey harbor area. The oil spills from simple barges and from high-tech supertankers, it doesn't matter. Our skills in drilling and transporting the oil apparently are not matched by techniques in either preventing or cleaning up a spill.
I believe we know quite a bit about oil spills. It's a function of how we use it.
It's Tim McKenna, a former Coast Guard captain and now a training specialist and program coordinator of the Oil Spill School at the Texas A&M University in Galveston. McKenna says his program is the only one of its kind in the nation.
And among other things, however self-serving this may sound, I think the training is one of the keys. I'd like to give you a brief example of that. During the Alaskan spill, one of my instructors went to Alaska to do some consulting work on that spill response, arrived on one scene where there were two pieces of equipment that are quality skimming devices, and they were not being used, and he asked why they were not being used, if they were broken or needed repair or what, and he was told that they were no good. And he said, "What do you mean they're no good?" And he said, "Well, they won't work." So he put them into operation, and they worked perfectly well, and they were very effective on that kind of oil. And the problem was nobody there knew how to operate that equipment.
Learning how to operate the equipment and how to respond in an emergency situation is what McKenna's course is all about. His students come from refineries, pipeline companies, oil transport companies, and some governmental agencies as well. The course takes a week, and McKenna runs a tight ship.
The classroom itself is just like any school classroom. It's part of the university where we have audio visuals and desks and regular lighting systems. We use slides and overheads and, you know, regular lecture type program discussing tools and equipment and methods of using these tools and equipment for oil spill response. And we also get into things like media handling and reporting to government agencies and what the laws are, and we get into debris disposal and a lot of issues. And we do that each morning. And then in the afternoon, we have a facility on Pelican Island, which is an integral part of Galveston Island, where we have booms and skimmers and sorbents, and we have a fleet of small boats, and we actually deploy, the students do this themselves. They deploy booms into the ship channel. We simulate spills. We use a biodegradable cottonseed hull. It's just the shell from the cottonseed. We spill those and they act a little bit like oil floating on the surface, and these students respond to these simulated spills with booms and skimmers, sorbents, and they learn how to anchor booms in the current. And just it's a hands-on training program in the physical response to oil spills.
McKenna says the week-long course goes on right around the calendar year and usually has a waiting list. In fact, this year he has no openings.
You say this is a five-day, 40-hour course. What happens at the end of the course? Is there some kind of a final exam, as it were?
Well, yes. If you want to call it a final exam, it's a practical exam, though. During the week, the students, and we usually try to maintain 20 to 25 students per class. We have gone up to 30, but that's a maximum. And they, during the week, learn how to use the various types of equipment and gear, and they learn about each other, and by Thursday evening, they are formed into a response team. And the final test, if you will, is we give them a spill, report the spill to them, you know, a simulated spill, and we report the spill to them, and on their own, they use all of our equipment and go out and respond to the spill. And they are required to report to government agencies. We act as media people and go down and interview them, and we act as government regulatory agencies to go down and enforce regulations, if you will. You know, one of us will act like a Coast Guard officer, someone else will act like a fish and wildlife person. And we try to put all of the pressures on the response team that normally would be there in a spill response. And we videotape this entire response, and then we critique both verbally and through videotape, and we examine the records that they've kept and everything. And it's quite an effective means of teaching these people how difficult it is to put together a response.
McKenna says it is both difficult and exciting to keep up with developing technology in oil spill cleanup. The cleanup from the Megaborg, he says, has gone really quite well compared to how things might have gone, say, 5 years ago. And we learn much from each spill about how to deal with the next one. There is, he says, a connection between the Exxon Valdez spill and the one from the Megaborg.
To me, a very exciting thing that happened out here actually is twofold. Early in the spill, right at the very beginning stages of this spill, when the fire was raging out of control, but they had oil in the water already, there was a slick forming, and the regional response team gave permission to the on-scene coordinator, the federal on-scene coordinator, to use dispersants. And they did use dispersants and had good results. And it's been difficult in the U.S. to go through the bureaucratic process of getting permission to use dispersants for a long time. So this was, I think, a real positive step. And the next one is that they have been large-scale testing bioremediation, these little microorganisms that somebody has put together, and you mix them up into a slurry with water and spray them onto the slick, and these little organisms consume the hydrocarbons. And that testing, which has been done on a large scale, it's not just been little canisters, it's been acres of slick, has been very, very successful. So these are steps technologically, giant steps forward in U.S. spill response. And I think a good portion of that has happened because of the Alaskan spill, where they attempted to use dispersants or to test them, and they didn't get proper tests, and through bureaucracy they never did come to good decision making. And then the bioremediation part of it has just been at the test level on some of the beaches after beach impact. But in this case, they did both of these things prior to beach impact. I'm real excited about that personally.
Any teacher of any subject at any level of education can only do so much to teach, to walk with the students through the material. In the end, the test is not the final exam. The test is whether what was experienced in the classroom can be applied in the outside so-called real world. And McKenna is very optimistic about his students.
It's a very rewarding experience, and one of the reasons, or one of the methods of reward, comes from the fact that these are all grown-up people, but some of them come here only because their boss told them to come here. Others come here already possessing quite a bit of experience in spill response, thinking that they already know most of what there is to know about spill response. And one method of feedback that we use here is we request the students anonymously fill out critiques of the course, and we very consistently are told that they learned things that they had no idea existed in how to little innuendos of methods of using equipment that they never thought about, that they learn here, that really will provide benefit. When you're in a crisis situation, it's hard to be innovative when you're thinking. And these people learn some of these little secrets, if you want to call them that, ahead of time by coming to this school. Because we deal with this stuff every week, so, you know, we should be experts in it. They don't deal with it every week. That's one of the major problems with this kind of crisis.
Tim McKenna, director of the Oil Spill Cleanup School at Texas A&M University, Galveston campus. He says that over the course of this year, he will have trained 1,200 people, 1,200 who will be more ready the next time there is a spill. For the Environment Show, this is Bruce Robertson. The aerial spraying of malathion in Southern California has covered some 500 square miles. Though the spraying has been halted, groups like the National Coalition Against Pesticide Abuse believe the state will find a reason to resume its aerial battle against the Mediterranean fruit fly. Joy Newell asked Michael Bell why his coalition is opposed to malathion.
Because with all the proof that's in, all the conclusive proof that's in, malathion is indeed an organophosphate. It is a poison. It is designed to kill. It is designed to attack the nervous system of an organism. That includes an insect or a human being or an animal. And it's being sprayed on the general public.
Michael Bell is a member of a group called National Coalition Against Pesticide Abuse. He maintains the state is simply not giving the public straight information about malathion.
Now, we've got all kinds of state authorities telling us that there's just no harm from malathion.
Yeah. Well, aren't those the same state and federal authorities that told you that Agent Orange doesn't cause any harm? Indeed, aren't these the same people that told Lois Gibbs of the Love Canal not to worry about the cancer and leukemia that she saw in her area upstate New York, that the inert ingredients being poured into the Love Canal by Arm & Hammer was indeed not the problem? And all of it, of course, was erroneous information to protect the wallets of the state and the federal government.
The reference to Arm & Hammer being of Hooker Chemical,
yeah,
owned by Occidental Petroleum.
Yeah, absolutely. And the fact of the matter is we have been crying, spitting into the wind here. We've given our information to so many sources, and it's never really emerged.
Bell maintains the information about malathion's effects on optic nerves, the nervous system in general, on birds, squirrels, and insects is out there. But the general media, he says, isn't doing its job.
Although we attended demonstrations and we put on demonstrations, that was not the bottom line. It was to educate. So we culled information from researchers, from doctors, from oncologists, from indeed entomologists, all independent of the state. And we presented this to the general public, and then we presented it to the politicians, and then we presented it to the media. And the media did not pick up on it. They reiterated the state's position, such as the LA Times, constantly, saying, oh, well, but the state says that it's perfectly safe and there's nothing to worry about, folks, and see you next week. But they did not print what we gave them, nor did they investigate the information that we gave them, and said, look it up. You will see we got the same information from the World Research Foundation that indeed malathion kills. Malathion does cause chromosomal damage. It causes RNA, DNA damage.
Why do you think the media won't listen to you? The media, in this case, LA Times, but maybe you're telling me others have ignored you.
Oh, yes. It's because of the fact, it's hard to say why they don't do it. There's kind of a blackout that happens when it becomes a state position. No one wants to mess with the state, especially when they're backed by the federal government.
Cara Cipriello of another anti-malathion group, Focus, says other governments such as Israel and Italy do nothing about the medfly, and the so-called infestation has never destroyed more than 5 to tops 10% of their crops. Bell says state officials appear to not have enough conclusive data to make their case.
If indeed this is safe, where is their proof that it is safe? They do not have any proof, no reports whatsoever. They have keep saying, well, we have the reports, we have the studies, here they are. We say, where are they? They say, well, we can't present them because of many reasons. This took place on television for 6 hours when the LA City Council held a forum on it. And Joel Wax kept saying, Councilman Wax kept saying, well, where is your studies? Where are your studies that say it is safe? And Dr. Izzy Siddiqui, who is one of the heads of the Department of Agriculture, said, well, we have studies.
Bell and Cipriello reminded me of studies done after malathion was sprayed in Japan back in the 70s. The studies concluded that as many as 10,000 people in the spray area suffered vision problems and even blindness. And they're not spraying in Japan anymore.
No more, no more. In fact, I did a number of interviews for Japanese magazines and television, and they were aghast that we are spraying the public. Aghast. With that information at hand, how could you not learn from our mistakes? And, of course, our state says, oh, we're using a different mixture. And we said, what mixture are you using? Well, we can't let you know. Well, now the city has said, we want to see the mixture. We'd like to test it. And the state said, no. So now the L.A. County, L.A. City is suing the state. What is the state hiding, Joy? That they will not let us see what supposedly is safe that they are spraying on us.
Not only is the city suing the state,
right,
but NCAPA is apparently going another route,
yes,
and having the federal government sue.
Well, we're going to go through the federal government. We're going to try to get a temporary restraining order, and we are bringing them all kinds of information, and we indeed have found out, in fact, that the state has violated its own regulations by not living up to its the particular rules of applying for a quarantine exemption. There are so many regulations they have broken, and we have found out about all of them.
As to that lawsuit the city of Los Angeles has against the state of California, Deputy City Attorney Keith Pritzker says Los Angeles wants more information about the environmental effects of the aerial use of malathion. He also maintains the state hasn't been following its own rules about notifying people within spray areas. A hearing on the case is scheduled in about 4 weeks. For the Environment Show in Los Angeles, I'm Joy Newell.
Joy Newell reports for the Environment Show from KCRW in Santa Monica. When the Shuttle Discovery deployed the Hubble Space Telescope, deep space exploration entered a new age. Named for Edwin Hubble, the famed astronomer who observed and mapped so much of our universe from the Mount Wilson Observatory in Pasadena, California, until his death in 1953, the telescope will scan the universe with its huge 94-inch mirror from its orbit 370 miles above the Earth. Though long-awaited and even often delayed, Space Telescope, or ST, will not be sending study pictures just yet, though we have received just a few as a preview. For the next 3 to 6 months, NASA engineers at the Goddard Space Flight Center and elsewhere will be conducting a series of tests, and the tests will take very long because of the tremendous distances involved. But the tests amount to checking the tires and the oil and washing the windshield before you set out on a long trip. By early fall, we should have something to look at. While we wait for the pictures, I visited with Dr. Karen Quitter, chair of the astronomy department at Williams College in Williamstown, Massachusetts, to find out what we might learn about our own planet by looking outward.
Beyond a human curiosity, what is the mission, what is the purpose of Hubble taking a look into deep space? What are we looking for or expecting to see?
Well, without sounding too grandiose, we expect to, the scientific community, and in a larger sense, we human beings, expect to be able to learn the ultimate future of the universe, which is a pretty interesting thing to know, a pretty important question for the very long term. The main mission in terms of cosmology and studying what's beyond the solar system and even our galaxy is to make measurements of very distant objects like quasars to determine how fast they are moving apart from us. The current idea about the universe's overall behavior is that it originated in a Big Bang some 15 to 20 billion years ago, and the galaxies and quasars are all flying apart from each other now. And by studying how rapidly they're flying apart, we can infer whether they will continue to do so forever, in which case we say that the universe is open and infinite, infinite in space, infinite in time, and will continue to expand forever. The other possibility is that the universe is closed, meaning that it's finite in space and also finite in time, and that eventually, in 100 billion years or so, the galaxies will stop expanding because of their mutual gravitation slowing them down sufficiently to stop the expansion, and then the expansion will reverse and the galaxies will all contract and speed toward one another, aiming toward another conflagration, a big crunch, out of which may arise, yet another Big Bang. So the universe may be oscillatory in that sense, and we are in perhaps one of many cycles. So that kind of question, although it certainly doesn't affect what you do during the day or whether you should sleep at night, it still is a question that has been asked implicitly for millions, well, maybe not millions, but thousands of years since people had the capacity to wonder and to ask.
Also, one of the questions, though, that have been asked and wondered, what is at the edge of that universe? The image implies that, in fact, there is an edge. Is there an edge? And if you could go there, what would we find?
Well, there is no hard edge, because to have a hard edge, it implies that there is something on the other side, and by definition, everything that there is the universe. So you get into the conundrum of the final exam question, describe the universe, or define universe and give two examples. So that's not quite how it goes. When we say that the universe is closed and is going to be finite, it's actually finite in the three-dimensional space that we know of. An analogy might be, for two-dimensional space, the surface of a balloon. If you blow up a balloon, the two-dimensional surface expands. And when you let the air out, the two-dimensional surface contracts. But for a person who's restricted to living on the surface of the balloon, there is no edge. It's finite, just as the surface of a globe is finite. But you can keep going in any direction for as long as you want, and you will never hit an edge or fall off a cliff. In fact, if you keep going long enough, you'll come back to where you started. And theoretically, if the universe is closed and you start off in a given direction, you would come back again to where you started. Unfortunately, the calculation shows that that would take exactly as long as the universe would take to expand to its largest and contract down to the Big Crunch, to its smallest. And so you really wouldn't have much time to appreciate your feet if you were to do that.
But to continue that imagery, though, the mm-hmm. balloon is held or suspended in something, in space or in air. If you were holding the balloon in a room or out in the park in the city or something, it's held in air. It's not in nothing. And I think that's the question that comes is, well, what is this infinite space held in? What's beyond that?
Right. The two-dimensional balloon exists in three-dimensional space. And we, superior three-dimensional beings, look down at the ignorance of the two-dimensional beings. Our universe can be thought of in three dimensions of space, and yet another fourth dimension, the curvature of the Earth, of the universe, is in another dimension in which we cannot move willingly, just as the expansion or contraction of the balloon is in a dimension that is unknowable to creatures that are constrained to live on the two-dimensional surface of the balloon. And so we can't feel it. We can see its effects if the universe turns out to be closed. We'll know that the universe is, in fact, curved into that other dimension. But we can't move of our own volition in that other dimension beyond the three that we do experience every day.
So Hubble will be looking much farther than we've been able to see on Earth, or even much farther than astronauts and cosmonauts have been able to look. What will that telescope's eyes be able to see?
Well, the current estimates of how far away Hubble will be able to see range from between 5 or 7 to 10 times as far as the best ground-based telescopes we can see. And so that will extend our view by 5 to 10 times in terms of distance. In terms of actual volume, it's almost 350 times the current volume of the universe, because the volume goes as the square of the distance, and the cube of the distance, excuse me, so that we will be seeing much more of the universe than we currently know. So every large step out we take reduces the known universe to a smaller fraction of the entire known universe.
We received recently the last picture from Voyager 1, a photo from near the edge of our solar system showing the planets in their orbits. Some have called this photo the photo of the century. I asked Dr. Quitter what ST, though not as far out as Voyager 1, will be able to see of the Earth set against the velvet blackness of space.
The pictures that we take of the Earth or of the other planets, even though Hubble is in orbit around the Earth, the quality of the pictures will rival the quality of Voyager with the wide field and planetary camera that is aboard. And we'll be able to follow up on some of the discoveries that could only be done in a short time as Voyager was traveling its flight path. things like circulations of storms on Jupiter and Saturn and Uranus, and the discovery of the blue ovals on Neptune, and the features on the moons, Miranda, for example, that has amazing geology that you wouldn't expect for such a small body. So Hubble will be able to follow up on some of the things that Voyager gave us tantalizing hints of.
Many critics of the space program in general, including the ST mission, have questioned the costs versus the benefits of the various projects. Dr. Quitter says that specifically there will be some time when ST will be pointed at the Earth for atmospheric sciences to study the atmosphere, measuring the greenhouse effects and the extent of ozone destruction, for example. But, says Quitter,
Less explicitly, the images that we'll get of other planets will certainly be helpful in understanding and putting the Earth and the processes that are going on in the Earth in the proper context. From Venus, we learned about the greenhouse effect. On Mars, we see another extreme where there's no water, currently liquid water on the Earth, and we see the evidence of old riverbeds and channels and streams, and we see that without liquid water, there is no life. So, in a sense, the kinds of things that we're seeing are making us even more aware of how fragile life is. On the one hand, strong and able to adapt, but on the other hand, fragile because we have the power to damage our environment irreparably. And seeing these other dead worlds, beautiful in their own way, but dead for the kind of life that we know, should make us rise to the challenge of keeping the Earth a habitation for ourselves.
Dr. Quitter says it is somewhat presumptuous, even arrogant, for us to think that we can, with our puny instruments and brains, calculate the size and the meaning of the universe. But in fact, says Quitter, to be aware of infinity and our place in space and time is one of the reasons astronomers look outward. How does she feel measuring the Earth and the universe?
Precarious. I suppose that's the other end of the spectrum from the arrogance I spoke about jokingly a moment ago to the real humility of knowing that we really are on the razor's edge and we're privileged to be here and privileged to use our minds to learn as much as we can. And I think along with that privilege comes the responsibility of maintaining the Earth as a place where people can live. And so as much as astronomers look outward from the Earth, part of our minds are always set on it and mindful of how careful we have to be.
Dr. Karen Quitter, chair of the astronomy department at Williams College in Williamstown, Massachusetts. The space telescope has an expected lifetime of 15 years, during which time we will have developed something new and better. For The Environment Show, this is Bruce Robertson. Well, that's our show for this week. The Environment Show is a production of WAMC. Dr. Alan Shartok, executive producer. This is Bruce Robertson. The Environment Show is made possible by the J.M. Kaplan Fund of New York.